And now,
come on, babe, why don't we paint the town? And all that jazz, I'm gonna rouge my knees and roll my stockings down. And all that jazz, start the car. I know a whoopee spot where the gin is cold, but the piano's hot. It's just a noisy hall where there's a nightly brawl and all that.
Your Chilpack Hollywood Hour Top 10 with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
And all that jazz.
Dean Haglund, it is so odd, given that you are a man who once said, I don't like music.
Well, I should rephrase that. I don't like contemporary music. I think after basically Clear Channel and voice auto-tune came into existence that anybody who needed to express anything went to some other medium, and all that you have left are robots that, you know, go, I had an emotional reaction, blah, blah, blah. Let me tell you about it for 4.5 minutes. I don't care.
Well, so, and much as I was never particularly considered myself a fan of the horror genre and who's celebrating and championing the horror genre now, it's yours truly. So only Nixon can go to China, only Phil can go to a horror movie, and only Dean can do a top 10 list all about musicals.
Well, right. And so we should have our caveats laid down in terms of what are we talking about when we're talking musicals? What are our parameters that we put in there?
Well, that's good. I mean, I was looking at some of the ones that are on honorable mention, and I actually had 10. I won't get into all of them, of course, but one of them, right. You know, one of my favorite filmmakers and filmmaking teams was Powell and Pressburger, Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, and they did a legendary dance film called The Red Shoes.
Oh, yeah.
And it is one of the most exquisite cinematic experiences you can possibly have. And yet, it's all dance. And to me, the musical required not only the physical embodiment of self-expression, but also the vocal embodiment, and that the story had to be relayed. You know, and again, story being what a character is experiencing in the world, not the plot, but the arc that the character goes through needs to be expressed through song and dance.
Absolutely. And so rare in a lot of these musicals is that the song carried the plot forward through the lyrics of the song. Like you could think of many examples where everything just stops. Showboat, perfect example. They're just singing songs around the showboat, and there's nothing really, the plot is driven in the speaking parts in between the musical numbers. So you got to keep the idea that you put songs in that pertain to driving the plot forward through character.
One of the greatest films I've ever seen about music, and one which contains perhaps some of the greatest musical performances ever put on film. Indeed, they were all recorded live. Was the 1986-87 Bertrand Tavernier classic Round Midnight, which
yes, of course,
brought back to prominence so many great jazz musicians, such as Dexter Gordon, who was nominated for Best Actor. I think the name was Alexandre Tronier, did the production design, and everybody said, you know, the production design that he did, the acoustics in this were phenomenal. He built the greatest jazz club ever made, you know, on this stage so that we could record all this music live.
Right.
And this was the man who had been the production designer on the very first sound film. So what an amazing, you know, career arc that spanned. Yeah. But again, as much as I wanted to have that, where's the dancing?
Right.
Where's the physical expression and embodiment of this story and what the characters are experiencing. And I just felt if I'm doing a top 10 musicals, it has to combine both.
Right. And so for my case too, it was, biopics of musicians, a la Walk the Line, Ray, those sort of things, were all off my list.
I thought not about a biopic, but I actually thought about that documentary about Glenn Campbell.
Oh, yes.
All Be Me. And
I still haven't brought myself to watch it. I think I'd just cram my head off.
Yeah, and it's amazing. And there was another great music documentary, Keep on Keeping On. And so, yes, the song and the dance, yes.
Yeah. And so, and then, of course, what I'm looking for is not just a straight, we lock the camera off in the audience and record the great Broadway show from the Great White Way that was a smash hit. I think
Chorus Line didn't make the list
for that.
Yeah, we're talking about movies. I mean, we're celebrating musical movies, and so they really ought to be movies. They ought to be cinematic.
And imagination and imaginative retelling or restaging of these numbers in unique and various ways are things that made my list.
Well, I would love to hear. I'm intrigued. Let's start with number 10. What's number 10 on your list, Dana?
Okay, so number 10 is actually a celebration of one of the first great choreographers, cinematographers, 1933. Now, he did two movies in 1933, and the more famous one, of course, 42nd Street, would technically be under it, because this is Busby Berkeley, who came to fame doing these musicals in the Depression. But to me, the more favorite of the two is The Gold Diggers of 1933. Have you ever seen this one?
Yes, I have.
Yes. And so this is the one that brought the nation out of the Depression with a fantastic black and white lush of cinematography, including now often mocked and parodied overhead shots of dancers lying on the ground and in unison making star patterns and all that sort of thing. The Gold Diggers of 1933, of course, has a bit of a plot of out-of-work actors trying to put on a show. And the lead, I think, he's from a rich family, but he's in love with the chorus girl, and he has to take the stage. Sort of a ripoff from 42nd Street, but not quite. And this is Mr. Berkeley's, I think, greatest expression in terms of dance, music, and cinematography together. Funny side note,
yeah.
You know, he nearly died making the Shadow Waltz sequence because he was up on a giant camera crane lift, and the 1933 Long Beach earthquake hit.
Whoa.
Knocked him out of his chair, and he was hanging by one arm from the crane at like 40 feet above the stage.
Wow.
I know. Such a cool story.
Which you described as funny.
Yeah. Well, yeah, death-defying.
Welcome to our top 10 dark comedies. Okay. I knew I could count on you to go back to early sound era. So I'm glad that you began that way. I begin on the other end of the spectrum with the most recent film on my list. Number 10. 2002's Chicago. This is not a big surprise for anyone who just listened to the opening, because instead of our usual opening theme song by John Lawler, I included a little bit from All That Jazz, the number from Chicago. And I actually thought about this film just now while you were... no, I had always planned to have it on the list, but I think you actually described perfectly why it's on my list when you were talking about movies and how they can reimagine stage shows. And
right.
And this is what Chicago does so excellently, what director Rob Marshall does, along with his cast, Renee Zellweger, Catherine Zeta-Jones, Richard Gere, Queen Latifah, John C. Reilly, Taye Diggs, Lucy Liu, and Dominic West, I forgot was in this film. But
Really?
And along with the musical Moulin Rouge and the hip-hop-centered film 8 Mile, Chicago is widely considered to be responsible, along with those, for the reemergence of the musical film genre in the 21st century, because it had almost died out.
Right.
Many people favor Moulin Rouge, but again, because of songs and dance, this is the one that I would have to choose, because there is no dance in Moulin Rouge. It's all done by the editor. It's all done in, you know, in camera and in editor. You don't see people embodying anything. And
right.
Chicago, Rob Marshall, a choreographer, understands the importance of it's the human body that needs to be expressing these stories. The story, for those who don't know, two murderesses who find themselves in jail together, awaiting trial in 1920s Chicago, fight for fame because they believe that fame will keep them from the gallows. It was adapted by screenwriter Bill Condon, with music by John Kander and lyrics by Fred Ebb. And it was an adaptation of course, of a Fosse stage production. And the reinterpretation, so that many of these numbers are taking place within the imagination of the characters, really,
right.
I think, are what opened this up to modern audiences a lot.
Yeah.
And
and
allowed us to explore depth and psychology that isn't available on the stage. It won 6 Academy Awards in 2003, including Best Picture. The film was critically lauded, of course. First musical since Oliver in 1968 to win Best Picture. And not that box office really is all that important, but these numbers are staggering. It was made for $45 million. And worldwide, it took in $307 million.
Wow. That's a big deal.
Chicago, number 10.
Number 10. Wow. Well, when we think of imaginative restagings, you can't go any more than my number 9, the 1973 Norman Jewison-directed Jesus Christ Superstar, which was a Tim Rice... I think Andrew Lloyd Webber both did the stage musical, but to reset it in the desert as a hippie busload of actors that have come out to stage it in the desert and then embody the time of Jesus is an amazing expansion of what the stage play was. This, of course, had Jesus played by Ted Neely, of all things, who we later saw in Django Unchained, one of his first starring roles. And I remember my sisters getting the album, being all up on Ted Neely's looks in the face, as it were, back in the 70s.
Wow.
Have you seen this one?
Yeah, of course. You know, I was at one time in my career at the San Jose Civic Light Opera, a mini minstrel. And so I was a little bit of a musical boy.
I did not know this.
Yeah, but musicals like this kind of frighten me, and to this day they kind of disturb me.
Is it because of the singing, talky, operatic?
Yeah, rock operas, stuff I do not dig.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Because it's all over rock operas you do not dig.
I find everybody to be kind of dirty.
Well, as was the time, 2016 years ago, there was less running water in the desert, I'm going to suggest.
All right, but I do put rock into the musical with my number 9 selection, Dean Hagland, from 1964, A Hard Day's Night.
Oh, really? Now, that's interesting, because to me, that was off my list, because... it seemed they took the songs that were already recorded and tried to build a narrative around it, as opposed to the other way around.
So it's filmed at the height of Beatlemania.
Yes.
It stars all four Beatles, of course, directed by Richard Lester, who's such a gifted comedic director.
Yeah,
and
it was funny.
The film portrays several days in the life of the group. It was a financial and critical success, of course. Time magazine rated it as one of the all-time great 100 films. Reviews at the time of the film were mostly positive. One oft-quoted assessment was provided by the great Andrew Saris of The Village Voice, who labeled A Hard Day's Night the Citizen Kane of jukebox musicals. And think about this. It got Oscar nominations both for original score and for screenplay. For a musical to get a screenplay nomination. And it is so funny because it captures the humor and the characters of the Beatles. The Beatles are neither ad-libbing nor are they writing it themselves, and yet it really captures them. I said dance, and this is the loosest definition of it that I have in any of my films, because there's these numbers where they just have to, there's numbers where they're performing on stage, of course, but then there's more traditional musical numbers where they have to break out. They're so locked in by this fame that they're experiencing that they have to break out and be free and express their youth and find their joy. And so the dancing is perhaps not
running, jumping,
choreographed. It's running, jumping, youthful exuberance, but it's captured and embodied fully in the film.
It captures not only that, it captures that 60s of happenings. We got to have, remember, this was like an artistic movement of having a happening, which was a unscripted expression that just came from the mind of the creator. And so this sort of was, you set the cameras rolling and you have something happen and you record that happening. And that in itself is the expression of the art form. And to me, this movie is the exemplary of that.
People ask me who's my favorite Beatle. Ordinarily, I tell them I don't know, and I have my bodyguard slap them around. But but when I do, when it's people I like, I'll say that it's George Harrison. And it's a different conversation of why George Harrison was musically my favorite Beatle. But why performance-wise and comedically he's my favorite Beatle, here's an example of why.
You can be replaced, Chicky Baby.
I don't care.
That pose is out too, Sonny Jim. The new thing is to care passionately and be right wing. Anyway, if you don't cooperate, you won't meet Susan.
And who's this Susan when she's at home?
Only Susan can be, our resident teenager. You'll have to love her. She's your symbol.
Oh, you mean that posh bird who gets everything wrong?
I beg your pardon.
Oh, yeah, the lads frequently sit round the television and watch her for a giggle. In fact, once we all sat down, wrote these letters saying how gear she was and all that rubbish.
She's a trendsetter. It's her profession.
She's a drag, a well-known drag. We turn the sound down on her and say rude things.
Get him out of here.
Have I said something amiss?
Get him out of here. He's knocking the program's image.
What's your number 8, Dean Haglund?
Well, you know, I forgot to mention with Jesus Christ Superstar, you know, that was written after Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber did their university project, which was Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. And they said, wow, you could do all the stories of the Bible, just don't do Jesus. And that's how they did Jesus Christ Superstar. So I like musicals that have that go after unseemingly unmusical storylines.
Well, I do love kind of that rebellious streak, obviously, of, you can do any of these, but don't do Jesus. Okay.
Right. And so what could be more revolutionary than the story of Evita Perón and her rise to power in Chile at the height of fascism? And so my number 8 is Evita, directed by Alan Parker. Screenplay, I did not know this, by Oliver Stone, of all things, with Alan Parker, and of course starring Madonna as Eva Perón.
Who else starred in this? Who were the male...
Antonio Banderas was Che Guevara, and Jonathan Pryce as the bad guy from James Bond. We know Jonathan Pryce as Juan Perón. Who else was in there? There was...
You're telling me that a movie with Madonna has made your top 10 list.
I know. So, okay. Now, I gotta admit, Patty, of course... she's a very large Madonna fan and has slowly turned me over to her qualities as an artist that I had perhaps overlooked because thinking she was just popular or whatever. But having gone recently to her return to Sydney after 30 years and seeing the concert, there is I doff my cap to her talent, and thus reviewing all her I watched Evita again and appreciated it for its daring take on a woman who rises to to power in the height of political upheaval, in becoming the wife of Juan Perón and then the most beloved and hated woman in all of Argentina. So I got Evita as my number eight.
Okay. My number eight, and boy, I have a story to share with you about when one's love of a film goes too far and wrong. But mine, number eight, is from 1978, directed by Randall Kleiser, starring Olivia Newton-John, John Travolta, Stockard Channing, Jeff Conaway, and a host of memorable character actors, young and old, such as Didi Conn, Michael Tucci, Eve Arden, Dodie Goodman, Joan Blondell, Sid Caesar, and Frankie Avalon. It's Grease, and it was based on Warren Casey and Jim Jacobs' 1971 musical of the same name, about two lovers in a 1950s high school. It really captured, you know, the 1950s nostalgia craze right at the height of Fonzie. You know, but before it would get a little too creepy in a Reagan era sense. And it was successful both the movie was successful both critically and at the box office. $6 million budget, just a $6 million budget. It's made almost $400 million worldwide at the box office. Its soundtrack album ended 1978 as the second best-selling album of the year behind Saturday Night Fever's soundtrack. Here's the story that I want to share with you, Dean. You know you have made bad decisions in your life, and you begin to go through them decision by decision to see which one you might have, I don't know, chosen differently to undo the fact that it is 3 a.m. You're in Sao Paulo, Brazil. It is ungodly hot and humid. You are sitting in your underwear with four other sweaty guys.
Wow.
You are all drinking beer and watching Grease in Portuguese. At that moment, this is no longer cool, liking this film.
No, yeah, you crossed definitely a line there. Are all the songs also translated into Portuguese?
No. They were still in English. And of course, this little clip is from one of my favorite songs, and it was from a sequence in the film shot just around the corner from me at Marshall High School in Los Feliz.
Sandy!
Tell me about it, Stern.
Go ahead and question me, Dean Haglund.
Awesome. Now, have you been following this rethinking of Grease, where perhaps it's all the dream of Olivia Newton-John's character, who actually drowned and is perhaps in a coma and having this dreamlike fantasy, and then at the end, when the car drives off into the, not into the sunset, but up into the sky, she's actually dying at the very end. That's her death scene. And
so
that the whole thing...
This would explain then why when she shows up, because it's a dream and she's come out, That she's apparently been in a coma for 20 years and why she's damn near middle age when she first appears in high school. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm sort of saying. That, yeah, the summer fling is the only thing,
but
the
we,
last thing she remembers
so
before
she... And so we think... Now, this was never, obviously, a part of the Broadway musical, so it's completely added
no.
for the movie. And
I almost drowned that summer, right? That's one of the lines of the song. Or
yeah,
in the
but
plot,
the but that's not what the song means.
No,
it's all
no,
the lyrics are all sexual, using thinly veiled sexual metaphor. I hate to break it to everyone because I know everyone lets their kids do youth Grease musicals. This is a filthy, filthy show. There is nothing in this that is not blue and sexual. Okay.
Wow.
Anyway.
Okay. Good.
What's your number? Seven, Dean Haglund.
Seven. Well, as we said, we love the singing and we love the dancing. And
that would be why we're talking about musicals.
Exactly. And there's no better singing dancer group than Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. And what movie better exemplifies that than the 1935 Top Hat, where you have Cheek to Cheek and all the amazing dance numbers through it, including, I didn't realize this, but the one Piccolino, filmed in one take. Think of that. One take. That's the only existence of a 2-minute dance sequence, the Piccolino.
So that's true. And you can verify that, because, you know, there's the famous thing about Singing in the Rain, that dance number, Singing in the Rain, was one take. But that's belied by the fact that they spent 3 days shooting it. So
yeah. No, but this is, if you look at it, it's a single camera shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Fred Astaire was renowned for rehearsing up to 75 times before the camera rolled. So it's not like they just got up out of the trailer and danced that number and went back and had lunch. Apparently at the end of one of those dance sequences, Ginger Rogers said when she took off her shoes, they were full of blood. Because the blisters had burst, and that's how hard they were working on some of these dance numbers. Not to ruin how fantastic the musical is.
Well, I mean, this is jumping far afield, but I have to share this story. You know, Debbie Reynolds, who starred in Singing in the Rain with Gene Kelly, right? She was a gymnast, not a dancer. And
right.
Every top musical performer wanted, like Judy Garland, wanted to play that role in Singing in the Rain, and Gene Kelly turned them all down because he wanted Debbie Reynolds. And then he was apparently tyrannical towards her, like so brutal and abusive because she couldn't dance, even though, well, she never danced. Nobody claimed that she could. So so he was so mean to her that apparently one day Fred Astaire visited the set when they were shooting Singing in the Rain. And he heard this crying sound, and he found Debbie Reynolds hiding under a grand piano in the studio, crying. And,
oh, my God.
And she told him what had been going on, and Fred Astaire coached her privately, in secretive, so that she could do the dance numbers. And and then the great Good Morning dance number, which they spent literally all day from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. doing, she nails it, and like you just described with Ginger Rogers, everyone notices when the day is done that her feet are just bleeding uncontrollably.
Yeah, because you think of how hard it has to be to do big musical numbers over and over again, and trying to stay on budget and on time.
In brand new high fashion heels.
Yeah, not broken in. That's the thing. You know, when ballerinas get their first ballet shoes, they take razor blades to the bottom of them because the leather's so tight. You want to have that ability for them to be flexible. So you start hacking away at it so they can be broken in quicker. I don't think they let that happen on those glorious high heels and in glitter and all that sort of thing. So it must have been way harder to do, particularly for females. As they said, Ginger Rogers did everything Fred Astaire did, only backwards and in high heels.
I love that you have this film. I mean, Fred Astaire is one of my favorites, and we'll be talking more about him a little bit later.
Fantastic.
The Top Hat is your number seven. My number seven, and I kind of hope that this will be the last time that I have to pay tribute to this man because it's not making me any less sad. But number seven, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
That's right. I guess that was a musical.
Of course it was a musical. 1971, and none other than your friend in podcasting, Phil Lernes, played Willy Wonka on stage. Anyway, this movie version, directed by Mel Stewart, starring Gene Wilder, Jack Albertson, Peter Ostrom, Roy Kinnear, a great character actor who was also in A Hard Day's Night, and of course, Julie Dawn Cole as everyone's favorite Veruca Salt. It's an adaptation of the 64 novel Charlie and the Chocolate Factory by Roald Dahl. Film tells the story of Charlie Bucket as he receives a golden ticket and visits Willy Wonka's chocolate factory with four other children from around the world. Filming took place in Munich in 1970. The film was released by Paramount in 1971 to moderate reviews and really little or no box office. As we discussed when we celebrated the life of Gene Wilder, it did not become a cult classic until the 1980s after Warner Brothers had obtained it and started re-releasing it to television. And it was not a hit until the 1990s.
Right.
And, you know, you said, I guess technically that is a musical. And of course it is. You've got all every one of the kids has their own musical number, song and dance. You've got a Candyman song and dance at the beginning. There's a lot of song and dance numbers in this thing. What about the Oompa Loompas recurring number three?
Yes,
but
that's true.
But I will say that with the exception of Pure Imagination, the musical numbers are not my favorite parts of the film.
Yeah, that's why I was even going, oh, yeah, I had to think back to that there's actual musical numbers in there because I see it more, you know, the plot sort of stays with me more than the actual musical numbers.
But I would say this. You would only get away with the surrealism that the filmmakers brought to this. The color, the dark humor.
Yes.
In a Technicolor musical at that time. That's the only way you would have gotten away with those things.
Yeah, yeah.
And
so true.
And so for that reason, as much as anything else, I celebrate it. And here's a little clip from the one number I always enjoy.
Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three.
Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination.
What is your number six, Dean Haglund?
My number six, as we've already discussed, is Gene Kelly's Singing in the Rain, 1952. That's with Donald O'Connor, Debbie Reynolds, as you mentioned. So many other stars, of course. Sid Charisse, Rita Moreno, who later was in West Side Story.
Her part was mostly cut out, though, of Singing in the Rain. It was supposed to be a big part, and it mostly got cut out. But
isn't that sad?
How about Sid Charisse, though? She has a great cameo. She shows up in the big big dance number.
Yeah, she's the one of the dance. And Gene Hagen, of course, who you said, hilarious story that I didn't even know. She was just doing Judy Holliday. But, of course, this was on the mix for me for because this was the 50s where the new technology of the three-strip Technicolor. This was the camera that would split your image into three different through a prism, wasn't it? And you'd have three different rolls of film going through, one green, one blue, one red, and they would have that then sandwiched so that you got this ultra-rich, super-saturated, luxurious color that then exemplified the lushness of these musicals. Singing in the Rain, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers was also on my list just because of this Technicolor three-step process. And when you see them remastered today on a big 4K ultra screen, good God, does it look luscious. It's fantastic.
I love that a movie that is about, in some ways, how a certain technology transformed movies would be itself employing a technology that was transformative to movies.
Absolutely. Yeah, ironic. I guess every technological innovation sort of had an echo to its past technological innovations as it went forward. So yeah, I guess this three strip was like, oh, we have to now take advantage of this ability for us to have all of these colors. So then now your wardrobe, your production planning, your art directing all went for rich, luxurious, bright colors. I mean, you think of the umbrellas and the furniture in Good Morning and Good Morning, right? The couch is bright red,
yeah,
and all of that stuff. It's like so great. And the yellow raincoats, all of that stuff. Loved so much in this.
Well, since I told that story about Debbie Reynolds knocking it out of the park in Good Morning, Good Morning, and what she put into that dance, why don't we treat everybody to a little clip from it?
Why not?
And what a lovely morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
We've talked the whole night through.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Good morning. Good morning. It's great to stay up late. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
When the band began to play, the stars were shining bright.
Now the milkman's on his way. It's too late to say goodnight.
So good morning. Good morning, sunbeams will soon smile through.
Good morning to you and you and you and you. Good morning, we've gabbed the whole night through. Good morning to you.
Nothing could be grander than to be in Louisiana
in the morning, it's great to stay up late. Good morning to you.
Might be just as iffy if we was in Mississippi.
Well, it is interesting how some of these performers, Dean, will have smaller parts in one of these classic musicals and then go on to, you know, really make a mark in a later musical. And such is the case with Rita Moreno, who, of course, won an Oscar for 1961's West Side Story, which is my number six.
And come on.
And much like Singing in the Rain, which is that rarity, a great film co-directed, right? Because it was Gene Kelly and Stanley Donen. Here's another example of that, with filmmaker Robert Wise and choreographer Jerome Robbins co-directing the film adaptation of the 1957 Broadway musical of the same name, which of course in turn was inspired by William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet.
Right.
Jerome Robbins, of course, choreographed every single step that the actors took in that movie, not the dance numbers, every single motion that they made. So we talk about embodying story. Before I get into too much about the movie, I wanted to point out, we don't probably say enough about the writing. Like you talked about Oliver Stone writing Evita. Ernest Lehman wrote West Side Story, the movie.
I know, isn't that amazing?
He wrote North by Northwest for Hitchcock.
Yeah.
He wrote Sabrina for Billy Wilder. You know, Billy Wilder wasn't a slouch as a writer himself.
That's right.
And he
did The Sound of Music as well.
He would do The Sound of Music later, but he did Sweet Smell of Success, which is, the most hard-boiled noirish film, one of my all-time favorites. He did Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. That was not Edward Albee adapting his play. That was Ernest Lehman. So
look at that.
This guy, when you talk about a writer, there are writers, and then there are writers who are good no matter the genre, and that's Ernest Lehman. And, it might be odd for people to think about a writer being so good in an action genre and also in a musical genre. But for those of us who make films for a living, we understand how similar the breaking down, the rehearsing, the staging, and the shooting of action scenes and dance scenes and love scenes all tend to be.
Right. Absolutely. It's fascinating. This is, of course, my number five, believe it or not.
Oh, I did not. Who knew
ironically,
that?
I did. It's funny that you should say that. And, of course, as we talked before, putting story in. Now, this was in 1961, this was when Puerto Ricans were coming to New York to get jobs that were no longer there. The manufacturing had gone south, and so there was a lot of unemployed immigrants up by Columbus Circle, where this was all set in the time. And at a time when vivid racial divide was separating neighbors of New York to do this on Broadway, not blocks away from where that was actually happening, must have been, when it was on stage and on the screen, groundbreaking.
Yeah, you know, this is why a musical, you know, you think about this. There have been so many films that have dealt with the issue of racism, and there are some ways in which West Side Story is dated, right? Especially from a story and maybe plot point of view, it's dated. But because it's a musical and because everyone involved, from the composer to the choreographer to the cast, embodies primal energies that so often lead to violence in the real world... This film has not dated, whereas many meaningful, thoughtful films, dramatic films about racial tension have dated. But the primal energies being embodied are universal in this.
Yeah, absolutely. And to express that through music and dance, because that has that timeless quality to it, is a really smart way to go. And of course, Leonard Bernstein famously said, "Oh yeah, I've written a score. It's completely unsingable. Here you go." That's
I'm going to play a little bit from this score, but before I do, you know, amidst the cast of Natalie Wood and Reed Moreno and the great George Chakiris, Richard Boehmer, of course, plays Tony, and Russ Tamblyn plays Riff. And how odd that the two of them would co-star together for David Lynch in Twin Peaks so many decades later. It makes me think that maybe Lynch himself had just kind of I picture Lynch in a Brazilian hotel room late at night in his underwear with a bunch of men watching West Side Story, right?
Yeah, I can see it.
And at some point, oh, that's a cool idea, putting the two of them together again. Nominated for 11 Academy Awards, it won 10 of them.
Yeah.
It was the second highest grossing film of the year in the United States and, of course, received high praise from critics. West Side Story. Here's a clip of one of the great, great musical numbers, Mambo. You had another story you wanted to share about West Side Story.
Well, funny story about one of the 9 Oscars that I accidentally visited. My neighbor, when I was living in Hollywood, was George Chakiris. And I didn't really realize, because he was a jewelry designer at this point, and he and I would walk our dogs around the same block and area. And he said, "Oh, come on in." I think the dog wanted a treat or something. And there on his fireplace mantle was an Oscar. And I went, "Oh, what was that for?" Because, "Oh, I was in West Side Story." "Oh, cool." Like, had he not realized that it was him, his hair had gone gray at this point, and he's living the genteel life. But it was like, "Oh, look at that. There's the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor in West Side Story, 1961. How cool is that?"
My number 5 from 1964... directed by Robert Stevenson, produced by Walt Disney, starring Julie Andrews, Dick Van Dyke, David Tomlinson, Glynis Johns, Elsa Lanchester, Reginald Owen, and the great Ed Wynn, Mary Poppins.
Yes, now, a classic.
These songs were written and composed by the Sherman Brothers, who wrote so many great songs for Disney during the years. The screenplay is by Bill Walsh and Don DeGrady, loosely based on the P.L. Travers book series Mary Poppins. And, you know, the film itself is really considered to be Disney's crowning achievement. Because he was determined to be taken seriously as someone who could make artistic pictures. And this film, which combined live action and animation, focuses on nanny Mary Poppins, who visits a dysfunctional family in London and employs her unique brand of lifestyle to improve the family's dynamic. It touched upon themes that really were personal to Disney himself. The film was shot entirely at the Walt Disney Studios in Burbank. It was released to universal acclaim. It received 13 Academy Award nominations, the first time Disney had ever gotten a Best Picture nomination, and an unsurpassed record for any film ever released by Walt Disney Studios. It won 5, including for Best Actress. And and what's interesting about that was, of course, Julie Andrews had been snubbed that year by not being allowed to reprise her Broadway role in My Fair Lady. When George Cukor adapted that, it was decided they needed a movie star. So they cast Audrey Hepburn instead, even though that movie star could not sing.
And she had to be dubbed.
And bypassed Julie Andrews. Well, you can't say that the producers of My Fair Lady did the wrong thing. After all, My Fair Lady won Best Picture that year. But what is cool is that Julie Andrews beats Audrey Hepburn for Best Actress. For Mary Poppins.
That's something.
And it's earned more than $100 million at the box office. And
I appreciate this movie more now, seeing the Tom Hanks telling of the behind the scenes of how he fought with the original author, Saving Mr. Banks.
Right.
I believe. And that if that's a true retelling, how much, again, these movies, all movies, require the guy at the top to be passionate about the project that they're going for. And so you see that this was so important to Walt Disney and the lengths that he went to get the author to release the rights.
It is great movie making. And again, the combination of the live action and animation, this still might be the best exemplar of that. and there's some dark psychology at play in this movie too. I mean, it does not shy away from it. So, as some of his great animated features did not. Right? So, anyway, Mary Poppins, and here's a little clip of the great Julie Andrews.
In every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. You find the fun, and snap! The job's a game. And every task you undertake becomes a piece of cake, a lark, a spree. It's very clear to see that sugar helps the medicine go down, the medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way.
So what is your number 4, Dean Haglund?
Well, here we go. So now we're thinking about how to update the musicals and find it in a period of time of its own making. So I am fascinated, and I put this at number 4 because I am at times ambivalent and in times embracing of Baz Luhrmann's Moulin Rouge. Now, this is Nicole Kidman.
You can't see any dancing in that. That's, I'm going to have to disqualify you. You can't see any dancing in it.
There's mass crowd dancing in the Moulin Rouge sequence with the trapeze and all that. That is choreographed. And then there's, you know, intimate love scenes that are okay, so it's not Broadway dancing, but there is dancing because it's contemporary. They take contemporary elements. They're putting songs from Nirvana in there, elements and stuff like that. And so I disagree with you when I say there's no choreography, because the way Baz Luhrmann directs is that it's all choreographed. Camera, movement, actors.
Okay, no, that's exactly it. The camera does the dancing, not the people. There is no human expression. There's no genuine human expression in this thing. It's all mechanical. I remember when I first saw it, I said, wow, I just watched a musical about what it might be like to witness people having human-like emotions.
You didn't find those expressions exactly...
It's so mechanical. No, and I understand, I understand why it appealed filters. At the time. I do find it interesting that, like I said, this was the year before Chicago, and a lot of people love Moulin Rouge more than Chicago, and some people like Chicago more than Moulin Rouge, as if you have to only like one or the other.
Right.
When they're both responsible for bringing back the musical. But what I do find interesting is that neither of those men that made those movies have come anywhere within whispering distance of a halfway decent movie since then.
Well, isn't that, I did like...
Isn't that interesting?
I sort of liked his history of rap told through the Netflix miniseries, six
Who
episodes.
Who are you talking about?
Oh, there's a show, I forget now what it was called. I really enjoyed it. And it was on Netflix.
Okay.
Did you not see this? Anyway.
Can we cut that out since that has nothing to do with a movie? I just said that neither of them have come within whispering distance of a decent movie since then.
Well, okay, so he's...
So there's a documentary series on Netflix that one of them...
It's not a documentary. It's a dramatic series about the rise of rap. It's called The Get Down. And it's about...
And this is Boz Luhrmann or Rob Marshall?
Boz Luhrmann is the executive producer and directed the first episode and wrote and created by The Get Down. If you haven't seen The Get Down, it's actually pretty cool in the terms of how disco... brought us to rap, that brought us to DJ, then how Punkin was all involved in that in New York, in Brooklyn, in the time of Mayor Ed Koch and the strife and poverty that was going on in that city. So that's the Get Down aside.
Yeah, why did we even Moulin why did Rouge. We even talk about that? So
because you said they didn't do anything great.
No, I said they have not. They're filmmakers, and this is where we're talking about films. Not TV shows they might have executive produced, which means they took
TV
a goddamn paycheck so that somebody could put their name on it, because once upon a time, they didn't suck so bad. But
I'm stopping you there.
So you have, since Moulin Rouge, Boz Luhrmann makes Australia and The Great Gatsby. Remake with DiCaprio, two of the worst movies ever made. Rob Marshall sent Chicago, Memoirs of a Geisha, Nine, which might be the worst movie musical ever, Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. I mean, so anyway, the point that I was making was they both are so put together, though usually at odds of each other, but somehow, how the mighty have fallen. Anyway, continue.
Well,
to champion his Netflix documentary series, please.
It's not a documentary series. Forget it. Watch The Get Down and then come back to me on Boz Luhrmann's career. Anyway, the point of Moulin Rouge that I want to point out is that if you look at the beginning and end of that, it opens with a proscenium arch curtain staged, giving you the idea that all of this, the musical, the construct of the musical, is a facade, a fictitious reenactment of what is human emotion. So therefore, one could argue that what you see as artifice is in fact purposeful in a way to express that all filmmaking and stuff is within a staged construct.
Oh, right. I buy that. And I believe that it is a movie about artifice. Absolutely. That is not the way that people have embraced it, though.
Right.
Right. Artificial people embrace the artificial emotion of Moulin Rouge and think that it's emotional.
Ah, right. Well, I never thought that. I sort of saw it as a wondrous picture and of movement, even though you disagree. It's technically not dancing per se, but there you go. As my number four.
Yeah, I mean, this is why I brought this up at the beginning. It's from directorial and cinematographically, it's quite an achievement. I just would never be able to put it on a list where I had Fred Astaire.
Now you hit me right where it hurts, didn't you? Okay, I remove it.
No, there's so many people who love this. I mean, there's going to be people who are very, very happy that you included Moulin Rouge on this list.
Okay.
They're going to...
Whatever.
They're still going to be scratching their heads about Evita, but they're going to really be very happy. There are. I kid you not. This is a beloved, beloved movie, this Moulin Rouge.
I know.
You know?
And I know people who hate it just as much as you do, so that's why I'm controversial.
I don't so much hate Moulin Rouge as I hate people who love it.
All right. Well, okay, so good point.
Oh my God, this is one of the greatest tangents we've ever.
Watch The Get Down. I think you might like it.
I feel like the whole, from this point of starting to talk about Moulin Rouge until now, that might be our 10th anniversary show. Just there, just package that 10 minutes, and here's the best 10 minutes we've ever done. All right, my number four... it's like anticlimactic, everything from here on. Once you get to talk about a Baz Luhrmann rap documentary series. Number four is, I mentioned it, from George Cukor, Oscar-winning picture of 1964, starring Audrey Hepburn, Rex Harrison, Stanley Holloway, Wilfred Hyde White, and Gladys Cooper, It's My Fair Lady. Adapted from the Lerner and Lowe eponymous stage musical, based, of course, on the 1913 stage play Pygmalion by George Bernard Shaw, the film depicts a poor Cockney flower seller named Eliza Doolittle, who overhears an arrogant phonetics professor, Henry Higgins, as he casually wagers that he could teach her to speak proper English, thereby making her presentable in high society. Won 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Director. There are so many great set pieces in this. The first time I saw this was when I was in film school. And the costumes, the production design, the imagination in cinematically and somewhat surrealistically adapting these set pieces for the screen impressed me. But what impressed me more than anything was the use of time in this movie.
Oh.
How single musical numbers would span long periods of time. One of my favorites is Get Me to the Church on Time, which begins the night before a man's wedding. He says, hey, I'm here to party. Get me to the church on time. And by the end of this musical number, it's now the next morning, and it's time for him to be wed. And I've always been impressed with movies that really play with time in interesting ways. And this is a film that that uses song and dance to compress and expand time in really interesting ways. Here is a clip.
There's just a few more hours. That's all the time you've got. A few more hours before they tie the knot.
There's drinks and girls all over London, and I gotta track 'em down in just a few more hours. Set 'em up, me darling. I'm getting married in the morning. Ding dong, the bells are gonna chime. Pull out the stopper, let's have a whopper, but get me to the church on time.
What is your number three, Dean Haglund?
Oh my gosh. Well, if you're scared of rock opera, you'd be frightened to death of 1975's Tommy by The Who, directed by Ken Russell. Holy smokes, have you seen this one?
Of course
this
I have, yeah.
Trip you out. I mean, Oliver Reed, Anne Margaret, Roger Daltrey, Elton John, Keith Moon. Think about Tina Turner as the asset queen, Pete Townsend's in this thing, Jack Nicholson. It's an all-star rock and roll.
This is the second musical in a row that leans heavily on Elton John, I would like to point out to you.
does it lean heavily? He just sang Pinball Wizard. I don't know,
but there's a lot of... And see, I always believed when you said you didn't like music, I blamed Elton John for some reason.
Well, later Elton John, I'll give you that. But early 70s Elton John, I can...
Don't kid yourself. I actually... one of my honorable mentions, if we went through the whole list, would have been The Lion King. And that's Elton John, Tim Rice. So anyway.
See?
Yeah.
Well,
I don't like... rock operas frighten me, but cuddly lion cubs singing, I enjoy. All right.
Oh, really? That get murdered and there's a murderous lion?
Oh, spoiler alert.
Oh, my God. Like, who hasn't seen it?
You know, they're making a new movie musical out of The Lion King based on the Broadway show, based on the animated movie. It's just another example, like you always say, of the snake eating its tail and shitting that out and then eating that. I love it. Anyway, so please, Tommy, yes, this frightened me when I was a kid. No question about it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So he's a psychosomatically deaf, dumb, and blind kid who becomes a master pinball player, and then that forms a religious cult. You know, that's an easy thing to pitch in the room, isn't it?
That old chestnut.
It's so common in musicals. Unbelievable. And, of course, this is the Who. At the rise of their fame, they decide to do a Broadway. I think it opened on the West End first and then went to Broadway with them playing it live, all the songs. And apparently it was much more stripped down. And when Ken Russell got a hold of it, he made these glorious set pieces, including Anne Margaret and the metaphor of consumerism, where she, in all white room with her white furs, starts watching the TV. And, of course, it starts spewing out beans and other stuff that she mashes around in as a result of TV consumerism. One of the great images of movie, musical, modern rock opera.
We are just movie. I mean, just that's the thing about some of these films is that they just had some of the best images, period. You know, yes, it's a musical, but I mean, it is so born out of the same kind of creative spirit that brought us, I think, Man Who Fell to Earth as well. And
absolutely.
Pink Floyd's The Wall, and so
That everybody went into these concept albums after the success of Tommy, and that you could do full length. I guess it was started with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart Club Band. That I guess came a little bit before.
Well, the album did though. Let's not talk about the musical made from that, starring the Bee Gees and George Burns. And Steve Martin.
God,
dear Lord.
Oh my God, that disaster.
So I think our lists are starting to bear something out, which is that you are still at heart this rebellious punk rock modern dance major. And I am nothing if not a traditional song and dance showman.
That's right. The traveling minstrel that wants to
of
entertain
death.
Crippertino.
How about that? Yeah. How about we make that a rock opera? The traveling minstrel of death.
Hey, I like it.
And my number three reflects this, I saw this for the first time this year, and it is already my number three favorite musical. I will sit down and dial up sequences from this movie every week to watch them. It's the Music Man from 1962.
Really?
Directed by Morton DaCosta, who directed the stage musical, and you can tell that this was someone who went to the stage, watched his show night after night, and started figuring out exactly where he'd put the camera to show perspectives he's unable to do on stage. To really make something 360 degrees. I mean, these sets that are designed like the public library set, where they would dance throughout it, and thinking three-dimensionally up and down as well. I mean, this guy could have only directed by someone who was watching this show every night going, I wish I could see this from a different angle.
Right.
It starred Robert Preston, who finally became an A-list movie star in motion pictures at age 44 after years of appearing in supporting roles in famous films and sometimes starring roles in little scene B pictures. He plays Professor Harold Hill, a traveling salesman in 1912. He arrives in River City, Iowa, intrigued by the challenge of swindling the famously stubborn natives of Iowa. Masquerading as a traveling band instructor, he plans to con the citizens of River City into paying him to create a boys' marching band, including instruments, uniforms, and music instruction books. The film also stars the so wonderful Shirley Jones.
Yeah.
Buddy Hackett.
That's right.
Hermione Gingold, who in addition to being just incredibly delightful, has the single greatest name in motion picture history. Paul Ford and little Ronnie Howard, as well as many, many members of the Broadway production. I'm not sure there is another musical that so instantly and so consistently brings me such joy as the musical.
Trouble. With a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool. We surely got trouble. Right here in River City.
Right here.
Remember the Maine, Plymouth Rock, and the Golden Rule.
Children
we got trouble. We're in terrible, terrible trouble. That game with the 15 numbered balls is the devil's tool. Oh, yes, we got trouble, trouble, trouble.
Oh, yes, we got trouble. Here we got big, big trouble.
With a T.
With a capital T.
Gotta rhyme it with P.
That rhymes with P.
It stands for pool.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you're like me, you've been really impressed with Dean Haglund's numbering throughout this show. And then it comes to light that as we get into our final two, he thinks he needs to cut one out because he has three in the final two positions. One might think that he would have cut out number 10 and just back everything up a little bit.
Yeah, well,
but
you know, my notes,
why don't we make it a tie, a two-way tie for your number two, Dean Haglund?
Yeah, okay. We can do that because... I have guilty pleasures, and you know, there's a
right. You mentioned
movies.
You mentioned that Baz Luhrmann Netflix documentary series.
It's not a documentary. Okay, forget it. Don't even watch it. Don't watch The Get Down. That's all I'm
saying. All right. So one of these is Phantom of the Paradise.
Yeah. How did you know Brian De Palma's very first? Oh my God, my guilty pleasure. It's a rock opera opening. It's a rock. Oh my God, it's Paul Williams. It's the story of Faust and Phantom of the Opera, told in a 1973 glam rock extravaganza where the young Winslow Leach has his music stolen from him and put into frames for drugs. He's put into Sing Sing prison, where they remove his teeth and replace him with silver. And as his job in prison is putting the vinyl albums into the sleeve of his music, he freaks out and escapes. And as he's escaping, his face gets caught in the record press of his own music that burns him and disfigures his face and vocal cords, to where Satan Swan, Paul Williams himself, finds him and makes him finish the rock opera.
So, you know, in the 1950s, the Fred Astaire musical The Bandwagon parodies this film 20 years before it comes out. Right? Because they go, it's about a rock opera jazz musical version of Faust, and they try to put Fred Astaire in it, and it just bombs so bad because it's ludicrous. So they turn it into a more conventional stage musical. Anyway, I know you. This, I'm hoping that that this is the one you were saying is your guilty pleasure, and that the
this
other
is
number
my
two.
Guilty pleasure.
Okay, all right.
Absolutely, all right. And it's a fantastic movie. And pointing out that this ran for a year in Winnipeg. I'm not the only one. Winnipeg-wide, this was like the number one hit. Every child of my generation had to see this three or four times, went and bought the album. Paul Williams came and toured and sang the songs on three nights sold-out shows in Winnipeg only. And in fact, Nir Vardalos, who saw Paul Williams in an audition, said, "Hey, I love Phantom of the Opera." And Paul Williams, without missing a beat, goes, "You're from Winnipeg."
Yeah.
And so clearly this was a phenomena to the city I'm from, and one of the great rock musicals. I tried to champion it here in Sydney. They showed it on TV, and everybody just sort of snubbed their nose at me. So they said, must be a Winnipeg thing. It's one of those movies you actually have to see twice, because the first time you're going to think it's terrible, but the second time...
I don't know. I watched it because of you, and I think, look, people are going to dismiss anything. They're going to thumb their nose at anything that's different. That's not
right.
That's not it, and especially if it's disturbing in any way. And honestly, I told you about this, that the texture of this movie was really unsettling to me. That there
yes.
is this texture to independent films from Canada in the 1970s of a wide variety of genres, like that... I'm forgetting the name of it, but that Christopher Plummer vehicle where he played Sherlock Holmes that Bob Clark made, which was an early indie from Bob Clark, who would go on to do, of course, Black Christmas and Porky's and Christmas Story. There's a texture to the filmmaking that really unsettled me, like I was watching snuff porn.
Wow. Well, see, that's the thing. I guess in Canada, because you said that was the quality of our filmmaking at the time, we didn't see that as unsettling, but actually as comforting and familiar. So I would imagine I don't see that quality, that texture at all in it. I see it as, oh, here's a polished Hollywood product that often came through our cinema screens, and this one has awesome rock music and fantastic special effects and a neon lightning bolt that fries the lead singer. I mean, how much more do you want in a great musical?
If you want more than that, you really need to consult a physician. I'll just briefly mention my number two, and then we'll get to your other number two.
Right.
My number two is, we already discussed it at length, it's Singin' in the Rain from 1952.
Yes.
And I just wanted to point out that the film was only a modest hit when it was released. So although we're talking about a lot of these being huge smashes, right, it barely made money its money back when it first came out. And it's not like it was a critically acclaimed or won awards, but not public favor. Donald O'Connor's win at the Golden Globe Awards and Betty Comden and Adolph Green, the screenwriters, win for screenplay at the Writers Guild Awards were the only two awards that the film won anywhere. And Gene Hagen's nomination at the Academy Awards for Best Supporting Actress was the only Oscar nomination it received. But it's been accorded legendary status, of course, by contemporary critics, and is frequently regarded as the best movie musical ever made and the best film ever made in the Arthur Freed unit at the legendary Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios. It topped AFI's greatest movie musicals list, and it's ranked fifth on their list of the greatest American motion pictures of any genre of all time. And yet, like I said, not immediately well received. So
right.
Might we 20 years hence be seeing Phantom of the Paradise on AFI lists?
Maybe. I think it's time to re-embrace it.
I would not hold your breath, but it is possible. Anyway, what's your your other number two, Dean?
Well, I wouldn't know about this if it wasn't for Steven Soderbergh's biography or autobiography, but it's the only movie that Dr. Seuss did the screenplay and conception for, The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, the story of young Bart Collins, who has to force these piano lessons under him under Dr. Terwilliger, and has flights of imagination of these horrible dungeons of fantastical Dr. Seuss production designs of rows and rows of boys having to play piano in a feeling of darkness and terror, similar, I guess, in a way to Willy Wonka, but more terrifying, more fantastic, and yet fun songs through there.
This film is definitely an influence on Willy Wonka, and when I was discussing Willy Wonka, I actually thought about bringing this film up, but I harbored hope that this was going to appear on your list. So
absolutely.
I didn't want to jump the gun, but it definitely, you can't watch both films
not see a comparison
and not see that it was an influence on Mel Stewart. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And think of the, and richly the cinematography by Franz Planer, who did so many other things. You know, he did Breakfast at Tiffany's and Roman Holiday and Caine Mutiny. And then did this. It's so fantastically encapsulates the child's nightmare of piano lessons in terms of its descent. Also, you know, all the shots looking into that room are always down these flight of stairs, these curving stairways that only Dr. Seuss, you know, when you see him draw it with his scratchy pen line, it's sort of fun. But when you actually see it in three-dimensional Technicolor stage-built musicals, it is frightening beyond belief. And I'm sure why it didn't, it was nominated for one Oscar for Best Music by Frederick Hollander. And, but other than that, it's kind of faded into obscurity. It's hard to even talk to people who know about it. And I did get an email from a guy who's obsessed with it, and he asked me if I knew any more about the shooting or making of it, which sadly I did not.
I once saw this projected at the New Beverly Cinema because I knew this was one of your favorite films. all right. Thanks to, well, pretty much just thanks to Baz Luhrmann's documentary Netflix series, this is going to be our longest show ever. So let's get to number one, shall we?
Right. What my number one? You can't think musicals without thinking about Bob Fosse. And you can't think Bob Fosse without thinking about All That Jazz. Dark exploration of his perhaps descent and or celebration of a life in musical choreography, jazz, and perhaps some other things. But yeah, All That Jazz. My number one pick for movie musicals.
I think it's interesting. You know, I began my list with Chicago, which adapted a Fosse stage production by getting into the psychology of the characters. And really, what's great about that it is drawing your inspiration from the movies of Bob Fosse. Right?
Right.
Because we're getting into the subconscious of these characters and seeing them writ large on the big screen.
And you got Roy Scheider playing... I mean, he's known as Joe Gideon, but it's definitely Bob Fosse's life and his deals with addiction and the fight for passion and all of that stuff. It's really quite fantastic and highly entertaining.
My number one, it has been called the favorite musical for people who actually like musicals. I mentioned it earlier. It's from 1953. It's directed by Vincent Minnelli, who we did our top 10 Westerns. It's possible to call Vincent Minnelli the John Ford of musicals. He's so closely identified with that genre. It stars the incomparable Fred Astaire. It's The Bandwagon from 1953. It tells the story of an aging musical star who hopes a Broadway show will restart his career. However, the play's director, loosely based as a parody on Orson Welles, played by the fantastic Jack Buchanan, wants to make it a pretentious retelling of Faust and brings in a prima ballerina who clashes with the star. Along with Singin' in the Rain, it's regarded as one of the finest MGM musicals, again, although it was only a modest box office success at the time. And the whole idea of needing to reinvent this aging musical star is actually born out of the real-life status of Fred Astaire, who by the early 50s, people thought of as someone you went to the museum to watch. And yet it would reinvent him and create another decade or more of relevant musicals for him. The songs were written by the team of composer Arthur Schwartz and lyricist Howard Dietz. Mm-hmm. Some of the songs in the film had been created for the original 1931 Broadway musical, which was also called The Bandwagon, with a book by George S. Kaufman, which starred Fred Astaire and his sister Adele. This movie I saw in film school the first time, and it has my favorite songs and dance numbers of any musical. And I find the story of this aging artist who has sacrificed so much, including ever having a family, to become the top of his field, only to find himself really alone when the days are numbered. It's a really emotional story, but the songs and the dances are so great. The jazz ballet number Girl Hunts, the single best dance number ever put on celluloid. And Sid Charisse, if I may say, if there is a more desirable romantic lead than Ingrid Bergman in Casablanca, it's Sid Charisse in The Bandwagon.
Fact.
And because 80 minutes is a long enough show, why don't we just play ourselves out with a clip of The Bandwagon, and we'll be back next week with another brand new installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
See you then.
Everything that happens in life can happen in a show. You can make them laugh, you can make them cry.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas.
The clown
with his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean. That's entertainment.
The lights on the lady in tights,
or the bride with the guy on the side,
or the ball where she gives him her all. That's entertainment.
The plot can be hot, simply teeming with sex.
A gay divorcee who is after her ex.
It could be Oedipus Rex,
where a chap kills his father and causes a lot of bother.
Belated spoiler alert.